Thanks, Larry.
I've been learning from Larry.
I'm surprised to hear he's learned from me. I'm going to be reading from a long text, excerpts from a long text. 2 years ago, July 21st, my brother died unexpectedly. He may have expected it, but none of us expected it. In Boise, and I've been trying to work through that in the years since. The Germans have a word for that. It's called Trauerarbeit, and it's the work of mourning. And this may not be important to anyone else, but it's very important to me to do this work. And it's a selfish work. It's work for myself. It also is hard for me to do this because I continually have the sense of that I'm using my brother. And time after time in this text, I come to the point where I feel like I'm misusing him. And part of an attempt to not do that is an attempt to be as honest about myself as I am about him. In one sense, I'm washing his dirty linen here. And I can only do that if I wash my own dirty linen. And that's painful at times. Before I start, I'd like to say that I'm very thankful for Sunstone for this opportunity to work through these ideas and present them. You remember President Kimball's wonderful prophetic statement that someday in Mormonism we would have fine writers and artists and thinkers. That can only happen if we have places like Sunstone to give us a place to write and think. And so I'm grateful to Albert and to others who have gone before. The title of this is Personal Effects. And the epigraph is from a book of poetry by a friend of mine, Alex Caldiero, Not Dreaming, Not Dreamed. It can fool me but once, my grandmother used to say. Death can fool me only once. Then it'll be my turn to laugh. A big black plastic clock with red hands. On the face, a stylized eagle and the words, Miller Genuine Draft Light, cold filtered. The second hand lurches in delicate quartz-driven 1 second segments around a brass post. A greasy pair of once white running shoes, work shoes. They stood for months under a grill. The soles are worn through. A pair of repeatedly resold black leather dress shoes. Marking time and use, they curl upward. A pair of Levi's. 5 patches vie for space on the back. Someone sewed them on with small, meticulous stitches. 1 tiny, khaki-colored can, labeled Emergency Drinking Water, for that horrible moment when there is nothing stronger in the house. A huge brown and black cardboard mask. A wall hanging. Boise, Cubist, African. A flat-backed, gold and black, life-sized plaster bust of a fierce Roman soldier. He wears a plumed helmet and a breastplate decorated with a lion's head. On the back it says, Mexico. Assorted unwashed pots and pans. 2 forks, 3 dirty spoons, 3 large wooden-handled cooking knives. Their ground edges are cunning. The blades gleam with use. A compact metal box packed with yellowing 3x5 cards, recipes. 1 set of car keys for a Plymouth. A cheap 10-speed bicycle, both tires flat. A shiny new aluminum bicycle pump. A black and white TV encased in white plastic. An ancient set of rabbit ears for the TV. 1 Dylan Thomas poem, typed out and taped to a cupboard. Do not go gentle into that good night. 1 condom, still sealed in plastic. Prime, lubricated with SK-70. a packet of handwritten IOUs for the Cactus Bar, $5, $10, and $20 denominations, an old spiral notebook, several pages are written on, a 1990 pocket PAL with addresses and telephone numbers, an imitation leather briefcase, various papers inside, a black leather wallet, inside a photo of a woman in her 60s, several business cards, and $223. A small GE radio, its battery panel ripped off, a manila envelope containing a few legal papers, puppies, a 1990 calendar, photos of puppies, as the title says, and a calendar, a small blue nylon sport bag. It has a small rip in one end. A fat roll of masking tape. J. Abbott, 113 and a half South 4th, 3rd, South 4th, number 3, is written on the tape with a black marker. A dispenser half full of liquid ivory soap. A small bottle of Wella Balsam conditioning shampoo for dry hair, nearly empty. A large bottle of Suave shampoo plus conditioner for normal to dry hair. A small bottle of Listerine antiseptic, half empty. 2 bars of Lux, the pure beauty soap, still wrapped. A large toothed red plastic comb with handle and a matching red handled brush with black nylon bristles. A brand new 100 tablet bottle of Advanced Formula Centrum, high potency multivitamin multi-mineral formula. From A to Zinc. Expiration date, October 1993. There are 115 tablets. A bottle 2/3 full of aspirin. A brown Max for Men hairdryer. A filthy yellow toothbrush caked with old toothpaste. A roll of Curity wet-proof adhesive tape, mostly used. A small self-closing plastic bag from Hannafin's cigar store. Same location since 1908, 124 Main Street, Boise, Idaho. The bag is stuffed with pipe tobacco, Boise Best, 2 ounces. The bag also contains a small pipe with a black plastic mouthpiece and a dark wooden bowl. A plastic spool of navy blue thread. A bent stainless steel butter knife with some sort of red-brown substance burned onto both sides of the blade. An unwrapped one-edged razor blade, a plastic bookmark and ruler with geometric formulas, and the admonition, stay in school. Upon graduation, join the aerospace team, U.S. Air Force. 26 gray, green, red, or white matchbooks advertising the Interlude Bar and Grill in Boise. A stylized young woman kneels to consider her putt. Her left hand holds a putter, her right hand a martini. A green matchbook advertises free cash grants. Call 1-900-USA-RICH. Valuable money-making information and the ABCs of receiving free money from the government. Now the $1 per minute, $2 first minute charge is the first step to riches. One pack of Kent 3 ultralight cigarettes, partly empty. A satin comforter, rust-colored on one side, tan on the other. Worn places in the satin reveal the cotton batting inside. A blue quilt tied with red yarn, dirty with splotches of white paint, cigarette burns, and grease. Several piles of limp, faded shirts and pants. 2 pair of nice corduroy pants, one black, one dark blue, both permanently stained below the knees with what looks like white paint. 3 pair of identical black and white checked slacks, restaurant uniform pants. 2 white chef's hats made of thick cotton and heavily starched. 2 collarless chef shirts, also thick white cotton and starched. Tightly woven cloth balls are the buttons. A pair of gray sweatpants and a matching gray sweatshirt. A blue sleeveless t-shirt, Fallen Angels Sporting Club, Angels Bar and Grill, Boise, Utah. 3 old sweaters, a worn leather and canvas coat, 2 limp bed sheets, a mini shopper, a brown vinyl wheeled bag with long strap handles. A picture frame with burlap for canvas. At the top of the burlap in black, a cross. Below the cross, a hand points upward. Below the hand, lightning bolts point upward. At the bottom, big letters spell one way. Four magazine photos have been thumbtacked to the pious background. Two of them feature similar women, one white, one black, both shirtless, both with their hair standing out electrically, both with breasts coyly hidden. The other two magazine pages show the bald heads of black women against a chain-link fence. Both are blindfolded with red cloths. On the reverse side of one of these is a graphic color photo of a woman's crotch, unrelieved by any artistic impulse. A roll of posters, a kitschy fantasy landscape, two posters from the Monterey Jazz Festival, 1982 and 1983, trumpets standing on chairs. A big original pencil drawing of a hooked trout. 26 paperback novels, most of them with the front cover torn off. Do not buy this book if the cover has been torn off. Eric V. Lustbader dominates the pile, but there are others as well. Neon Mirage, Mirage by Max Allen Collins. Mob Justice, another shotgun blast ate into the side of Reagan's once proud Lincoln. Vision of the Hunter by John Tempest. In his hands, his people's future. In her eyes, the promise of a love stronger than time. The Well of Loneliness by Radcliffe Hall. Banned in the United States. Foreword by Havelock Ellis. Hoyle's Rules of Games, second revised edition. A 1953 50-cent paperback edition of Edith Hamilton's mythology. The Dust Jacket of a modern library edition, The Philosophy of Kant. The book itself, Das Buch an sich, is not to be found. As you've guessed, that's a list of the things I found in John's apartment as I went to Boise. That's everything. Now come a series of journal entries, disconnected and connected. 5th of January, 1981. 4 days in Houston at the National Modern Language Association convention. Job interviews, the third year in a row. Then depression, lethargy, resignation. I wandered around, shambled through the streets, surrounded by people with jobs. Construction workers, businessmen, serene bankers. I sat listlessly in the airplane, unable to read or write, staring out the window, dreaming, emoting. Since arriving in Princeton, I've done nothing. I sit by the fire, hour after hour. I leaf through the pages of The Honorable Schoolboy. I watch football on TV. I play occasionally, desultorily with the children, and I sleep. I stayed with my brother John in Houston. I'm not sure how long it has been since I last saw him. He'd picked up the name Jay sometime in the last few years. With his friend Lee, in Lee's car, he picked me up at the airport. He was half drunk. I'd never seen him like that. Happy, nervous, sloppy. Lee is a thin, grizzled man, maybe 50. I asked John questions about Houston. He told me about a favorite Mexican restaurant where they serve giant margaritas. Lee was restoring a sprawling red brick house in Houston's Tenderloin, a section called Montrose. The house was built in 1908, Lee said. More recently, it was badly damaged by fire. Its tile roof glowed red-orange against the spooky green of a dusty, overgrown, neglected park. Crisscrossed boards clamped some of the windows shut. Others were shuttered. The dark rooms were in various stages of long-term repair. After John cooked some ham and eggs, we sat around the kitchen table without much to say. Soon after nine, I said I needed to get a good night's sleep to be ready for the interviews the next day. I slept fitfully on a narrow cot in a big, stuffy closet half-filled with boxes. The next morning, I donned my interviewing suit and walked 10 minutes to Houston Center. No tenderloin that, but clean-swept streets that impose right-angled order on spectacular and banal corporate architecture. An elevated freeway and a no-man's land of talking parking lots divided the two worlds. Continuous tape recordings instruct parkers to take their ticket from the machine at the center of the lot, center of the lot, center of the lot. It is a weekend and there are no parkers. just a tinny approximation of a voice. Take your ticket. Take your ticket. Take your ticket. If a tree falls in a forest and no one is there to hear it. I interviewed with good places, Bucknell, Vanderbilt, Washington, Columbia. Then I walked back past the still-talking parking lots. That night, we drove to a potluck dinner in the basement of the Unitarian Church. A big man dressed in a Levi jacket, T-shirt, Levi's, a hanging chain, black engineer's boots, and sporting cropped blonde hair seemed to be in charge, although a softer-looking Unitarian pastor had organized the get-together. John was really drunk now. Between bites of fried chicken, he blurted out his secret, putting into words what the juicy kiss I heard the night before had already suggested. As we ate, I attracted more attention than I was comfortable with, the male gaze. I tried to focus on John, a handsome man, my brother. Others were focusing on him as well. Back at Lee's house, John attempted to give me things, a set of knives, a cookbook, a fountain pen. I asked if he'd done any drawing recently. He told me about his new business venture, Shackley, vitamins that would make him, and me if I wanted, healthy and rich. I tried to describe what I knew about pyramid schemes and begged off. John had old bruises around his eyes, and his nose looked bruised as well. In response to my question, he described winning a drinking game called Pass Out. He walked me around the house to show me the art hanging on the walls, garish copies of Rembrandt and Constable on black velvet. Lee claims to have a real Da Vinci drawing back somewhere in a box, John said. We spent the evening playing cards, and we reminisced about our childhood, important and trivial shared memories that finally made us feel like brothers again. Do you remember when Mom broke her toe trying to kick Carol? Remember Grandma Abbott's riding mower? Remember those kids who dismembered the lizards we sold them? Remember when you fell off the top bunk and smashed your nose? And when I got my nose broken in Little League? For 17 years, we lived together, shared a room, exchanged blows, hung our shirts in the same closet. Since then, we've been virtual strangers. And perhaps we were strangers then as well. 24th of August, 1988. I'm back from a family reunion in a canyon north of Salt Lake. The summer, high mountain landscape has worked in me since returning to Nashville. The smell of sage, especially, awakened childhood memories. I took lots of photos of Grandpa Hilton taking brittle steps down by the stream, fly rod in his hand. A family shot of me, John, Jill, Carol, Christy, Paul, Jeff, and Mom. Dad was on our minds a lot during the reunion, especially the final evening when Christy, Paul, and Jeff gave their accounts of the winter accident. That same day, John, Grandma Hilton, and I cut up chickens for dinner. John was quick, skillful, professional with his knife. We had no warning of the deadly salmonella shifting from chicken to bare hands. Salmonella rented impotent for the others in the Dutch ovens, but in our three bodies it went wild. Separately and similarly, our stomachs heaved and knotted. Our bodies shared a violent cramping, an instinctual bodily attempt to purge and thus save. Salmonella made no distinctions between man and woman, young and old, smoker and non-smoker, hetero and homosexual. Food poisoning is a violent, egalitarian business. So is death. The first day of the reunion, Mom told me about a call she got from John while he was still in Houston. He said he was in trouble, that he needed $400, or he would go to jail. She sent him a check immediately. Then she got a call from some man with John there next to him, who said that she had filled out the check improperly and it couldn't be cashed. Would she send a new one? She did, and they cashed them both. 22nd of July, 6:30 p.m. Christy and I sit in Mom's living room while she calls Carol and Jill and Paul and Jeff to tell them that John died early this morning. Or maybe it was yesterday, we're not sure. Driving over after she called me, I had troubles keeping my mind on John. I thought of the things I usually think of driving that way. Joseph at work at Macy's. An aluminum boat for sale by the roadside. Interspersed ragged memories and thoughts of mortality. I will drive up to Boise to get John's things. 23rd of July, 7 a.m., Jerome, Idaho. After a four-hour drive in Christie's van, we arrived at 2 this morning. My first time at Jill's. Mea culpa. We talked a lot about John on the way up. Mom told about the washer and dryer he bought her out of the blue. She made him take them back, she said, because they were the awful kind that Grandma had. Besides, John needed the money for school. I can imagine other undercurrents as well. After a short sleep, we drove west toward Boise. As we drove along the Snake River, Mike, Jill's husband, a hay hauler and a hunter, talked about the Snake Canyon between Twin and Jerome. A long time ago, it was split apart. You can see the sides. They fit perfectly. Some say it split at the time of the crucifixion. At Mountain Home's Gear Jammer restaurant, we ate a huge breakfast. Suddenly, the thought of John on a coroner's table. The autopsy was scheduled for 9. It was 9:30. John's new address, 425 West Jefferson, number 41. It's a flop house, a house of last resort. A big, sagging, once white, clappered building. It stands across the street from dignified granite and marble government buildings, next door to a gentrified house in which a brass plate advertises several lawyers' names. All eyes, and yet not seeing much, we trail across a gray wooden floor. Partially dislocated mailboxes hang from the wall of the front hall. Ahead of us, a dyslexic sign is affixed to the frame of an open door. No children, no pets, Lila and Dean, managers. Out of an overstuffed room rises a heavy, unhealthy-looking woman lost in a shapeless dress. I'm Lila, she says. How can I help you? We explain we are John's family, come to get his things. She says she is sorry. He seemed like such a nice man. She gives us a key. We pick our way up flight after flight of rickety stairs, glancing out of the corners of our eyes down long corridors. Battered doors along both sides. Number 41 on the top floor has 3 doors to the hall. One from the bedroom, one from the kitchen, one from the living room. The living room ceiling slants down to accommodate the roof. The place reeks. The smells of generations down on their luck. A double bed with permanently gray sheets dominates the bedroom. It looks like someone had a fight on it. Drawers are open, and someone has strewn John's clothing around the room. 3 red plastic milk bottle crates stacked up next to the bed support an old black and white TV, its rabbit ears precariously balanced on the top. An overflowing trash can stands next to the dingy bed. The layers of trash provide archaeological witness to the last few days. On top lie 2 pair of clotted protective latex gloves, discarded, I suppose, by the health workers who came to pick John up. Under the gloves appears a layer of cigarette butts and ashes mixed with vomit. Beneath that, a loose silver stack of crumpled Olympia beer cans, along with an empty peach can and 1 of applesauce. Underneath everything, at the archy, at that beginning point, lie smashed medicine boxes, aspirin, amoxicillin, alupent. Through double doors that open onto a tiny balcony, I find a kitchen chair and 2 more overturned stacked plastic milk bottle crates that fill a few square feet. I sit there with my feet up on the crates, next to an ashtray on the railing, and try to see the world John may have seen while sitting there. Down below, across the domes, flags, official state buildings shine against the rich green of carefully tended grass and shrubs. Directly across the street stands the Idaho Supreme Court building. I watch dark-suited men and women move briskly over the landscape, each attached to an attaché case. I imagine John relaxed on this balcony, kicked back, smoking a slow cigarette, sipping a cold beer while they march along in their sweaty uniforms of privilege. Christie comes out and points to a needle stuck into the side of a chair. A short piece of purple thread hangs from its eye. At my feet stands a can of turpentine replacement paint solvent. Mom looks ill. She says she has to get out of there. I tell her I need to stay. We start putting things into plastic garbage bags. When we have it all, I insist that we take every scrap that isn't obviously trash. Mom wants to get rid of everything. We carry it down the stairs and load it into and onto the van. A bearded man and pregnant woman come along the sidewalk and stop to talk with us. They are delighted to find we are the family of the deceased. It's the second one he's found, she says. My husband was the one who first went into the room and found your son dead. Someone from the cafe where your son worked called the managers here and asked them to check to see why he hadn't come to work. My husband helps him take care of the place, so he went up. What do you mean, the second one, I ask. He found another dead person in another apartment here, she explains, just a few weeks ago. She's proud of her man. We drive over to the TNA cafe where John had worked for a couple of years. Pepsi, formerly Vic's Cafe, 7 a.m. to 8 p.m., Monday through Friday, Saturday 7 a.m. to 2 p.m., free marriage counseling with a complete meal. Yes, we are open. Please seat yourself. Thank you. Help wanted. Inside, a woman, mom's age, gray hair, white shirt, blue apron, puts salt and pepper on tables. We tell her who we are. She bursts into tears. Ted, the owner, a big man in suspenders, sits us down at a table and sheds a few tears himself. Jay worked for me regularly for 2.5 years, he said. Sometimes he slept in Saturday mornings, but we just sent a waitress over to wake him up. He always came right over. I called him the hard luck kid. He was always hitting me up for an advance on his wages. He always had a good reason. He got hit by several cars. He got mugged. He had good stories. I always gave him the money. I knew he would pay me back. One night he asked me for $100. The next day he walked in with flowers for all the waitresses. There was a W-2 form at John's Things. It reported his total wages for the last year as $13,000. A cash register tape, just 3 days old, lay crushed on John's kitchen table. A case of Doral cigarettes, 2 6-packs of Olympia beer, 1 bottle of Listerine, 2 bars of soap, a can of applesauce, and 1 of peaches. A balanced diet. On the dresser were 2 pink patient copies from Physicians Immediate Care Center. The first is dated July 9, 1991, 9:23 a.m., the second July 18, 8:32 p.m. They list the following information. Sex, male. Date of birth, 6-3-51, age 40, home phone, no home phone, social security number, 585-46-4127, address, 425 West Jefferson, number 41, employer, TNA Cafe. The statement of problem or injury from the first visit says that John had a productive cough, yellow-gray, post-nasal draining, chest tightness, very weak, SOB times 2 weeks. Arms and legs go numb, onset 1 month. Last time he had pneumonia, one side of body was numb. Exam, height 6'2", weight 150, blood pressure 116 over 74, pulse 104, temperature 100.4, resp 32, current medications, ASA, allergies, NKMH. Other observations, smokes 1/2 pack per day, pneumonia 3 times in the last 3 or 4 years. Under physician's exam and history, it reads, arm goes to sleep if he lays on it. Legs will go numb if he sits too long in one position. Lasts for a few minutes until he shakes it out. Patient denies wheezing or asthma. Coarse breath sounds and prolonged expiratory phase. Given 2 puffs alupent and clearing of coarse breath sounds. Bronchitis with possible bronchospasm. Amoxicillin 300 milligrams. Alupent, inhale 2 puffs. Recheck if any problem. Don't smoke. $37, payment by the 19th. The second report, 9 days later, states the problem or injury as lost 20 pounds in 1.5 weeks. No energy, short of breath, headache, lost appetite, chills. Under exam, it lists the following. Blood pressure 118 over 84, pulse 80, temperature 98.9, resp 28. Now current medications are aspirin, amoxicillin, and alupent. The exam reports, seen last Tuesday, given the DX of bronchitis, started on amox. States he forgot to eat and lost 20 pounds. HX, heavy ETOH and heavy tobacco, 2 packs per day. Denies homosexual activity. 0 BRPPR. I can't read much of what follows. The word dirty crossed out, adenopathy, dry, lungs clear, abd soft, CXR, underpenetrated, Tyne test. The cost this time is $149. $45 for the exam, $104 for tests and a chest x-ray. Nearly 2 weeks' salary. July 27th, 9 p.m. Sitting alone in the window seat in my daughter Marin's room. It's getting dark. A welcome breeze blows through the window. Contradictory desires. To shun disorder. To get as far away from the chaotic edge as possible. Or to leave the anal retentive order of normal life and head for the edge. Both of these are responses to John's death. I feel the urge to put on his clothing, to step into his cracked shoes, to live what I know, that his was a marvelous human experience. But I also am driven to wash the car, water dry spots in the lawn, empty the trash, shave and shower. I want to suck in all the odors of John's smoky, moldy, maggoty apartment. And I washed his clothes as quickly as I could. I was angry at the perfectly nice bishop who conducted John's funeral and was disgusted by the prayers hinting at an orthodoxy that would damn John. I utterly reject any religious totalitarian abstractions that put people in their supposed places. I want no part of a self-righteous religion that would separate me from my brother. And I was lifted by my grandmother Hilton's comments on how much love there was in that room. And her question, don't you think the Lord loves John with this same love? With that question, she mooted ideas of a terrible judgment. She expects no puny, resentful human judgment. The funeral was then a dialectical religious experience, rejection and embrace at the same time. The 18th of December, 1991. Dream. I was trying to get into an apartment, but the front door was locked. I swung myself up through a window, then up through another one. Lying on her floor was an aged woman, not too surprised to see me. She seemed immobile, but alert. A turban topped her head. We talked, and while we did, I looked out her window. Policemen with rifles were chasing a man. The man didn't seem overly concerned as he moved along. It was obvious that the police were not going to shoot, and that they would not use force of any kind. I entered the scene and raced after the fugitive. I tackled him and held him down until the police could arrive. It was my brother, John. Did John grow up with the same childish sense I had for our mother's word, BM? Was that for him, too, a simple, clear, unambiguous word for excrement? Did he also fail to realize that it was an abbreviation for bowel movement? 7 of us grew up hearing this word in exactly the same context, out of the same mouth. Was there a moment of discovery in each of our lives, away from the familial, absolutely unreflective usage of the term, when we made the connection between sounds and letters and words? What kind of family so needs to abstract excrement? Could a member of such a family write an essay on shit, like John Berger's recent essay? A week ago, I cleared out and buried the year's shit, the shit of my family and of friends who visit us. And if we couldn't talk about shit, then what enormous barriers were there to keep us from talking about our emerging sexuality? 26th of May, 1992, London, 7:30 p.m. I'm at the Cottesloe Theatre to see Angels in America, a new play by an American writer, Tony Kushner. It's my last night in London. I have just enough money to buy something to eat after the play, so I don't buy a program. Instead, I steal a glance at the one held by the person in front of me. Real-life characters in the play. Pictures of Roy Cohen and Ethel Rosenberg. He turns a page. Other terms, phrases, and people. A portrait of Joseph Smith. And an Egyptian illustration from the Pearl of Great Price. What's this? I spend the last of my money on a program. Angels in America, a gay fantasia on national themes. Part 1, Millennium Approaches. This is more than I counted on. Kushner writes in an introduction, I wanted to write about three things. Roy Cohn, who had just died, AIDS, and Mormons. I had no idea what Mormons might have to do with Roy Cohn or AIDS, but I wanted to find out. The angel is described as the angel Joseph Smith incorrectly identified as Moroni. Wow, the intermission after Act 1. I walk out among women and men with whom I have just laughed and suffered. A lot of men. It makes me keep my gaze down and shun contact. A gay Jew and his drag queen lover who is dying of AIDS. A Mormon lawyer who protests when Cohn takes the Lord's name in vain, whose neglected wife is on Valium, and who fights to kill his homosexual urges. I think as we walk out that I am a very strange and appropriate audience for this play. A Mormon, an American, and a brother of an AIDS victim. The play was written for me. Two. End of Act 2. The Mormon admits he's a homo. The Jew moves out on his dying lover. Roy Cohn has AIDS, is losing his right to be a lawyer, and needs the Mormon, Joseph, to cover for him in the Reagan Justice Department. Joseph's mother sells her Salt Lake house as the second act closes. She's off to New York. Salt Lake is described as baked dry, abundant energy, not much intelligence. That's a combination that can wear a body out. There is violence, self-destruction, blood dripping from the dying man's ass and Joseph's ulcer. Betrayal, self-loathing, openness. Act 3 is as good as the first two. The monolith of white America, white, straight, male America, which is not unimpressive, even among monoliths. Joe does the right things in the morality of this play. He tells Roy Cohn he can't be dishonest and he won't take the Washington job. And he decides to go to hell and spend the night with Lewis. I felt solidarity with my fellow humans as I came out. I better say as I left the theater. And then I got a little... and then I got a little spooked walking alone through the streets of London to my hotel. A play about gays, Jews, Mormons, and angels. I wish I could have seen it with John. January 6, 1993. Dream. I was fighting John like I used to. I was on top of him, pounding his back and arms with my fist. I had control and was compelling his compliance with whatever it was that I wanted. Then I felt pain in my testicles, excruciating. I looked down and found that while being pounded, John had grabbed my balls. Now he controlled me. The turnabout was inconceivable. But repeated squeezes helped me to understand the new state of things. 31st of January, 1993. Dream. I was beating up on John repeatedly and brutally. He brought in an accountant who was going to investigate every aspect of my financial life. I would have to provide endless, detailed documentation. 23rd of February, 1993. Taped on the cabinet of John's kitchen in Boise, an 8.5 by 11 sheet, brown, watermarked, typed on an old typewriter. Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. The wise men at their end, no dark is right. Because their words had forked no lightning, they do not go gentle into that good night. Good men, the last wave by, crying how bright their frail deeds might have danced in a green bay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Wild men who caught and sang the sun in flight and learned too late they grieved it on its way. Do not go gentle into that good night. Grave men near death who see with blinding sight. Blind eyes could blaze like meteors and be gay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. And you, my Father, there on the sad height, curse, bless me now with your fierce tears, I pray. Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Dylan Thomas. A poem about old age, death, a dying father. About life, light, and rage. About rhyme that stacks up sensuously beyond meaning. Night, light, right, night, bright, light, flight, night. Sight, light, height, night, light. Day, they, bay, way, gay, pray. The repetitions are incantations. Wrinkled, watermarked incantations taped to the side of a cheap pine cupboard. Gay rhymes with pray. The light with night. I will not let John's light die. Nor mine. I will curse him. Bless him. I will rage, burn and rave. And yet the night is good. A raging hymn to the night. John and I shared a room until I left for college. Bunk beds. Sometimes he on the top, sometimes I. At night he often wanted to sleep while I wanted to read. Or vice versa. One of us would turn off the light. The other would turn it back on. There were smashed fingers. And I remember many furious leaps down or up to smother him with punches and imprecations. He always, finally, cried. And then turned the light back on or off. Late one summer, our last one together in that room, the room began to stink. In the heat of the mid-afternoon especially, the still air reeked of rotting garbage. Repeated searches revealed nothing more than lost dirty socks. Getting a shirt out of the closet one day, I noticed something odd about the white dinner jacket Maurice Tanner, a well-to-do Indian trader and family friend, had given me the year before for junior prom. Clothing of that extravagance was beyond the pale of our family's Spartan junior high school teacher economy. So when I saw that one shoulder of the jacket was marked with reddish-pink stains, I went bonkers. Up above the jacket, stuffed in newspaper, back on the highest shelf, I found half a watermelon, hidden there and forgotten for over a month by John. What was once a rigid green and pink structure was now a gently fizzing heap. John's secret pleasure. Necessarily secret, because of seven siblings who would have inhaled it had they known. 5th of May, 1993. I've been reading Derek Jarman's Modern Nature. Jarman pays attention to the details of nature, flowers and gardens, weather. He's also gay, and that is in fact why I'm reading his journal. How else to get into a mind bent like John's? But when discussing violets, Jarman invites me into a secret garden of violets to watch him and another schoolboy take off their uniforms to share that lovely feeling. I want out. As John Updike said, I just don't have that circuitry. That doesn't make me virtuous. It just makes me like the majority of the population. The Spiral Notebook. Two entries on the first page. The first is a post-suicide attempt quotation from John Fowles, the Magus. I reevaluated myself. I saw that I was from now on forever contemptible. I had been and remained intensely depressed, but I had also been and always would be intensely false, in existentialist terms, unauthentic. I knew I would never kill myself. I knew I would always want to go on living with myself, however hollow I became, however diseased. The second entry on the same page, beautifully juxtaposed, lists the basic ingredients of barbecue sauce: brown sugar, cayenne, vinegar, and tomato sauce. Tenth of May, 1993. After a week of cold rain, snow, and gray skies, this morning dawned bright blue and warm. The big, clear, white gibbous moon, a calf sucking its mother's teat, and a huge pile of steaming, composting manure. They all remind me as I spin along on my bike that life renews itself, that nature is a constant. Over the weekend, I read John's missionary letters from Italy. From what my mother had told me, I expected uncommunicative communications, constant requests for money, reports of trouble, and depressed silences. John communicated all of that, of course, for he was a fairly normal 19-year-old. But his letters were profoundly moving as well. From his first city, Genoa, sent November 17, 1970. Dear family, sorry I haven't written the last 2 weeks. I wrote 2 weeks ago, but never sent it. I don't really have that much to say. I think it's dumb saying the same things every week. We just got back from seeing Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. It wasn't much of a show, except for the scenery and the music. It only cost 48 cents, though. The last 2 weeks haven't really been much. All our contacts are fizzling out, it seems. We started teaching a young boy, 17, about a month ago. He came to every meeting, was reading the Book of Mormon, but didn't believe in God. I've gotten so I really love this guy, Michel. Last Sunday he came to church and was really upset, down, etc. He finally told us he wasn't going to come anymore. He said he knew... Last Sunday he came to church and was really upset, down, etc. He finally told us he wasn't going to come anymore. He said he knew our church was the best church around, but that he just couldn't believe in God. He doesn't know why, but he's been sincere. He tried to believe, but he just can't. He tries to pray, but how do you pray to somebody who doesn't exist to you? I've never felt worse. I can't tell you how much I've learned to love him. It hurt me so bad. I'd give anything if he could accept God, get an answer to his prayers. I never knew I could be hurt so bad. But when he told us he wasn't coming anymore because he couldn't be part of us and not believe everything, he wants to believe, but he tried. And it didn't work for him. I don't know why. I almost started to cry. Well, that's that. I just pray for him every time I pray. I can't see how God can let this happen to such a great guy. I don't know. And he's halfway down the page right there, and his pencil just slides off the page. And that's in the end of that letter. There's also a photo with that letter. And it shows, in all our family photos, John is either crying or angry, forced to be in the photo. He's happy in this photo. His left arm stretches around a broadly smiling young man dressed in a green suit, white shirt, and a colorful tie. His skin is much darker than John's, and he has a big mop of curly black hair. John's left hand, a gold ring glinting on its ring finger, rests on his friend's shoulder. On either side of them stand church posters, one showing angels in white with their hands on the head of a kneeling Joseph Smith, another depicting the angel Moroni blowing a long trumpet above swirling clouds. I see it as an intimate religious scene. A missionary loves, or he is no missionary. 25th of January, 1971, from Cagliari, Sardinia. Dear family, I was transferred from Genoa this week to Cagliari, Sardinia. I'm really sorry to leave because it's a great town and great people whom I love very much. Michel came to the apartment Thursday and I got to talk to him for a little while. He's a great guy. I'm sure he'll accept God and the gospel when the time is right. Then he, Elder Nelson, and I went to the port in a taxi. I bought my ticket and paid for my bike. It cost me about $15.20 in all. It was raining, so we waited inside till 5. Then we took my stuff on the ship. They got to come too. They waited until 5:30, and then Elder Nelson left, but Michelle waited. I was on the ship. He was on the dock. We couldn't talk because of the distance and the wind. We just looked at each other. Finally, at 6:30, I was supposed to leave at 6, he had to go. We said goodbye. I sure felt sad and realized how good a friend he'd been. I'm sure I'll get to see him again, though. We just looked at each other. I admire John immensely in this moment. I love him, and I sure feel sad. The same impulse that made him a fine missionary may have made it impossible to live with his Mormon self. My own mission had moments of expressed love, but from a much greater, safer, less human distance. 24th of February, 1971. Dear family, my companion was sick Sunday night, Monday and Tuesday, but other than that, it was an all right week. Sister Calabresi is still sick, and so is her daughter. We haven't been able to meet with them for about 2 weeks now. They didn't come to church yesterday, and the son had a 2.5-minute talk, so we didn't know what's going on. Thanks for sending my letter. It was from a guy I met when I went to the Junior Civitan Seminar 3 years ago. Love, John. Is this the same Junior Civitan guy Mom thinks introduced John to gay sex and taught him how to give big presents to attract others? How much of that story does she in fact understand? She describes it as a crime against humanity. But attraction to another human feels more like a rare moment of grace, I think. A teacher needs an erotic attraction to her students, and they to her. A missionary to his investigators, and they to him. A friend to his friend, a counselor to her client, a parent to his children, a lover to the lover. In one letter, John describes the source of Joseph Smith's success as his love for his fellow men. When the gay poet Tom Gunn describes a former lover who has decided to adopt a child, he helps me glimpse the interconnectedness of different kinds of love. He turned from nothing he had done, or was, or had been, even while he transposed the expectations he took out at dark of Arrow's plane, features undisclosed, into another pitch where he might work with the same melody, and opted so to educate, permit, guide, feed, keep warm, and love a child with the same melody. April 15th, 1971, from Cagliari. Saturday we had a very wonderful and exciting experience. Sister Accardi was baptized, the first of many here in Cagliari. When the president was here for the conference in March, he said that he would get plane tickets and fly over if we had a baptismal service of four people. Well, remember the Calabresi family? They've been estimated for the 17th of April. The Lord, the Holy Ghost, have revealed to my companion and me that this is the right date. And as the handbook says, an estimation is always a baptism. So we're going to have a few baptisms here on the rock. Their only real problem now is tithing. Sister Calabresi told us how their money situation is. He receives 130,000 lira a month, about $220. And after the rent, taxes, and these kinds of things that have to be paid, they have 40,000 lira, $64, to live on for the rest of the month. With tithing, that would leave them with $32. Well, they're going to have to pay their tithing with faith, but the Lord wants them to be baptized, so they'll overcome this obstacle. It's Easter in Italian. It's Easter. It's really a big thing here, too. They have chocolate eggs, vacation from school, and horrible church services. Last night we went into one of the churches here, and it's sickening to see the paganism. Apparently the Catholic Church rakes in the dollars this time of year. The incense, the statues of the Madonna or Mary, of all the saints, the priests officiating over the communion or sacrament. It's really sad to see these people doing things like this. Well, that's the reason we're here. Such naive, straightforward faith and narrow-mindedness. The Catholics would be ecstatic to rake in 10%. Why did alcohol become so necessary in late years for John? Perhaps to keep self-destructive, deeply held beliefs from surfacing. It's sickening to see the paganism. It's really sad to see these people doing things like this. More early tolerance for others might have allowed him to be kinder to himself. I'm going to finish with a letter. John was made a zone leader in Milano and given a car, which he soon wrecked. He didn't like being a zone leader. He didn't like driving a car in Italy. But this letter comes from that time. Friday night, we went out for baptismal interviews with the Carnialetto family. Brother Carnialetto and I went into the kitchen. We talked for a while, started the interview, read from the scriptures, and were periodically interrupted. First, the plates on the refrigerator started rattling. He moved them. Then a stack of clothes fell for no reason at all. Other things like that shouldn't have happened. He told me it was Satan trying to interrupt us, and I fully agreed. We spent about an hour and a half talking, clearing up problems and questions, and then we knelt in prayer. Sincere, beautiful prayer, pleading with the Lord to help him know the truth. Then I offered a prayer. It was one of the most beautiful experiences I have ever had in my life. We both felt the Spirit of the Lord, which was very, very strong. Oh, it was beautiful. The next day they got baptized, and it was so beautiful, so very, very beautiful. They asked me to confirm the Father. Was I ever grateful? I love them as much as any family I've ever baptized. Brother Canialetto paid me a very high compliment. He said that I really helped him during the interview to make up his mind. They say each missionary can touch the heart of certain people, and I believe it. So do I.
I'm only going to take about 5 minutes, and I think that's about all we have, but I'm glad Scott was able to share as much of his writing with you as he has. I've had the benefit of seeing even more, and so my comments will occasionally refer to things that you may not have heard but that are there. Scott began today by asking whether he is using his brother inappropriately, and whether he's just writing for himself. And I think what we've heard today answers that question for us. When Albert called me a couple of weeks ago and asked me if I'd respond to Scott's presentation, he told me that it was okay if I turned down his request. He wasn't all that certain that a formal response was possible. In a way, Albert was right, because what Scott has done is invited us into the interior space of his life. From the sacramental listing of personal effects at the beginning to a confession that you didn't see at the end, but which I did, of perceived failure at friendship with his brother. Scott explores themes that are personal, private, and intimate. And when someone undertakes such an exploration genuinely, how can others respond? But I'm here to respond because Scott's exploration spoke to me, making me think about things that I most often leave comfortably ignored. While Scott writes about something extraordinary, the AIDS-related death of a brother, we are not simply voyeurs being invited to view Scott's pain and suffering from a distance. Rather, we are invited to join with Scott in his exploration of core themes that most of us encounter in our own lives: the search for understanding, the struggle with personal inadequacies and failures, the meaning of family, and in the end, the longing for redemption. My first reaction to reading Scott's excerpts was gratitude for his courage, for his openness, and his candor. My second reaction was one of guilt, as I was glad that next weekend it would be me that would be at my gay brother's sharing of vows on the 10th anniversary of his partnership, and that it was Scott who was writing about his dead brother. My third reaction was one of kinship, as I understood that Scott's search for understanding and redemption mirrored some of my own best impulses, and that I was not isolated from the same forces that compelled Scott to confront himself and the world he lives in. When Scott wrote that I only did two things to ease John's way, the 3 days in Houston and the scowl letter I sent him, and when he later confesses that he was a lousy friend to his brother, I feel love and empathy for Scott, and I'm confronted with a moral imperative to reflect on the relationship I have with my gay brother. Mostly, I wonder what I have communicated to my brother. What do I want him to hear from me? Clearly, I want him to know that I love him, and that I feel that he really is my brother, that I want him to experience that sense of connection. I want him to know that my opinions far outdistance my understanding, that the religious is the most vital dimension in my life, that I think his partner is a good guy, that I want my brother to be happy, that I don't believe in my capacity to have the right answers, even as I eagerly give answers, that I believe in kindness and in living our lives with grace, even as I failed to do so. So have I eased my brother's way? Have I eased anyone's way? In the end, that seems to me to be what matters. That is the hope that counters the pain and suffering of this life. Did Scott live in grace? Not perfectly. Do any of us? I'm painfully aware of my own failures. But Scott's writing, it seems to me, is an act of hope as he struggles to make sense of his life and the life of his brother. And in my life, that act of hope is a prophetic call to try this with kindness, to struggle for understanding, to try to love, and to believe in redemption. I need prophetic calls, and while I usually don't think of Scott as a prophet, his words did what a prophet's words are supposed to do. They challenged me, they gave me hope, and they gave me a sense of God's grace. Thanks, Scott. And with that, unfortunately, our time is gone, but we appreciate your being here today. Thank you.